TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. The Pathology of Wealth. Just as the Republican candidates for president compete for the most eloquent praise of capitalism, the social critic and noted author Michael Parenti gave his first talk of 2012. One by one, he was debunking some of the myths of capitalism, that capitalism creates jobs, peace, democracy, and wealth. In part one of this program, Parenti's funny and elaborate critique included gems such as, "The best investment a capitalist can make is to buy a politician," or, "The super rich like recessions because they can buy up their failing competitors and break unions and break and tame people too." To prove the point that recessions are endemic to U.S. capitalism, Parenti gave a long list of them, beginning with the first recession only 3 years after the Constitutional Convention. Also in part one, he commented on Bernie Madoff.
"The crimes and crises of corporate America are not, in my view, an irrational departure from a rational system. I don't think Bernie Madoff is an aberration. Quite the opposite. I think it's the converse. They are the rational outcomes of a basically irrational and amoral system. The multi-billion dollar government bailouts are themselves turned into an opportunity for pillage. Not only does the state fail to regulate, it becomes itself a source of plunder, pulling vast sums from the federal money machine. The public treasury is about the best investment that capitalists can make. You know, I mean, they'll spend a few million dollars on lobbying and some campaign contributions, and then they'll get a contract for an oil reserve that's worth $20 billion. I mean, there's no investment you can make in the private business world of a few million and come out with $20 billion.
Then, in a turn of argument, Parenti said that capitalism has one very powerful enemy, and that's capitalism. Left entirely unchecked, capitalism eventually devours itself, which is an interesting dilemma for those who demand that the market must be entirely unregulated. He also issued a warning to those who want to depress wages to the lowest possible level. Who then, he asks, is going to keep consumption going that capitalism depends on? In today's conclusion of Michael Parenti's talk, The Pathology of Wealth, he explores the alternative of socialism. Here's a short preview.
"Isn't socialism a dream in theory and a nightmare in practice?" That's my own phrasing. You like that? And then I answer it. I say, "No." I taught in Albany and I taught at Stony Brook. This was at Stony Brook, I remember. Student got up and says, "Socialism? I can't imagine it. How would it even work?" I said, "Well, you're sitting in it. You're sitting in socialism right now. That chair that you got your butt on is a socialist chair. The teacher you're talking to is definitely a socialist. The building, everything, State University of New York is a socialist institution. It's publicly owned, and you're able to go here because it's publicly owned and you can afford it." This is before the days when they incrementally privatizing all of the public institutions. "And what about it? The teaching was as good as any private. In fact, on Long Island, I compared it to a few other Long Island private schools, the school at SUNY was much better." And I said, Oh, it feels all right, I guess, yeah." You know? "Okay, you got qualified teachers. We had better students, too, than the private schools did."
Michael Parenti's talk on The Pathology of Wealth, Part 2. Before exploring socialism, Parenti elaborates what all is included in the term pathology. He refers to addicts and psychotics.
Now, let's talk about the addicts and the psychotics who are in charge of this world in this country. The money addicts, they grab more and more for themselves. Many of these people have more money than they could spend in 1,000 lifetimes I mean, even if they lit every cigar with a $1,000 bill, there's just no way they could spend all that they have. They can't even figure out sometimes how much they got. They're driven by what begins to resemble, though, an obsessional pathology, a monomania that blocks out every other human consideration. They're more wedded to their wealth than to the earth upon which they live. They're more concerned about the fate of their fortunes than about the fate of humanity. They don't see the disaster looming ahead, or if they do, they don't seem to care. Another disposable resource is the environment itself, as you know. There was a New Yorker cartoon. In fact, I reproduced it in the 9th edition of Democracy for the Few. It was a great cartoon. It shows a guy at a lectern like this at a business conference table, and there are people sitting along there, and there's a big chart in the back with the arrows going up, you know. And so it's obviously he's making a business report, a stockholder report, and he's saying, "And so, while the end of the world scenario will be rife with unimaginable horrors, we believe that the pre-end period will be filled with unprecedented opportunities for profit." You see. And that's not such a joke. You know, years ago, I used to say, these idiot plutocrats, they're not going to recognize the dangers of global warming until the North Pole begins to melt. That was the term I used, North Pole. Well, now we know the Arctic is melting. I mean, it's just going apart. And you know what? They still don't. There are now companies that are emerging to show you how you can make money on global warming. What are the new angles or approaches? And they're deliriously happy about two new developments. One is, with the melting of the Arctic, this opens up access to oil reserves. Yeah. You could get them, you know, you could have done it with it right through the, you can drill right through ice and get to that oil. But the trouble is, the Arctic is just ice. It's not like the Antarctic. It's not ground. And it moves. So that would snap your pipelines, and it's just impossible to do. But now they're going to be able to drill directly to the oil. And the other delightful thing is a Northwest Passage. Yeah, it's open now. We'll be able to go right across. You don't have to come down all the way down to Panama, all the way down around the Cape or anything like that. I mean, the dream that's older than Lewis and Clark, a Northwest Passage, and we're going to go do this, right? And I'm sitting there and I'm saying, wow, you know, I'm missing something here. And what are they going to drill for? They're going to drill for the same fossil fuel that's already melting the Arctic. And as you know, that fresh water, they say in one day there's enough fresh water, it melts off the glaciers to provide drinking water for New York for a year or something. But that water is of such immense amounts that it is slowing the Gulf Stream, which is already going slower and slower. That Gulf Stream that's coming up is the only thing that's keeping Europe as a temperate zone. And these extra cold winters that Europe is getting, and in fact, Midwest and the Northeast in the U.S., with global warming, we may all end up freezing to death. It's kind of ironic, but... So what are the alternatives? The alternatives to wealth pathology and to corporate transnational capitalism. Socialism? Well, isn't socialism a dream in theory and a nightmare in practice? That's my own phrasing. You like that? And then I answer it. I say, no. Here's where we get to the sensible part of this talk. Instead of treating this question as a grand clash between two ideologies of socialism versus capitalism, communism versus democracy, you know, stuff, look at the actual practices and realities that are before your very eyes. We just already went through one about public utilities versus private utility. One is socialistic. It's not for profit. It's publicly owned. It gives better service at lower rates. You don't find the criminal activities you have with PG&E. They got $45 million that they were supposed to use for repairs, and they spent it on a statewide referendum to prevent any kind of public ownership of utilities. Remember that? And then the people in San Bruno remember it even better than we do, including those who lost, 8 people died. That was money that was supposed to go to those repairs, you see. So there's private capitalism at work. And under socialism, if it's properly regulated, they would have fixed those pipes. Look at the actual practices. I had students taught in Albany, and I taught at Stony Brook. This was at Stony Brook, I remember. Student got up and says, socialism? I can't imagine it. How would it even work? I said, well, you're sitting in it. You're sitting right in it. You're sitting in socialism right now. That chair that you got your butt on is a socialist chair. The teacher you're talking to is definitely a socialist. The building, everything, State University of New York is a socialist institution. It's publicly owned, and you're able to go here because it's publicly owned, and you can afford it. This is before the days when they, they're privatizing, incrementally privatizing all of the public institutions. And what about it? The teaching was as good as any private. In fact, on Long Island, I compared it to a few other Long Island private schools. The school at SUNY was much better than all. I'm not going to name names, but that's definitely it. And I said, well, it feels all right, I guess, yeah. You know? Okay, you got qualified teachers. We had better students, too, than the private schools did. Yeah, but what about socialism in the Soviet Union and China? A failure. Well, don't forget, in both cases, those were siege socialisms, is what I call it in a book I wrote called Black Shirts and Reds. That is a socialism that's trying to develop and is denied a normal environment in which to develop. It is constantly under siege. It's constantly under attack, constantly being invaded. And anyway, it did work to some measure. In both China and the Soviet Union, hundreds of millions of people in both of these countries went from abject poverty and misery to having sufficient food and housing and medical care and good education. A historical accomplishment never seen before or since in history, for whatever other crimes, mistakes, whatever else was done. Compare China with India. They're always comparing China with India. You want to know one of the differences between China and India? In India, there's mass misery. About 70% of the population still lives under a brutal, feudal system. And China had 40 years of communism. And in those 40 years, they had 40 years of literacy, 40 years of co-op farming, infrastructure development, and the like, and 40 years of eliminating and getting rid of that feudal class, which they did. I was reading an account of an Indian village where the women share and rotate menstrual rags. I'm giving you a little too much information here, I know. That's how poor, I mean, they wash it out. What passes for clean water in the village, you lend it to another female member of the family. I mean, how poor is poor? Of course, there's a stratum in India during that period when you had a sort of social democracy going, people got educations and all that, and they've developed. But that's still a minority of the country. So there is historically the difference there. Of course, now, with more consumer prosperity in both China and Russia, you have more wealth for a select few and more poverty for millions. But still, I mean, I don't want to idealize China because there are real problems like corruptions and, I mean, there are like 100 demonstrations a day throughout China because of all sorts of problems and malfeasance and such. But I just ask this, do we really want certain essential services run by people whose primary interest is the accumulation of profit? Medical care. Do we really want rich hospitals, rich insurance companies, rich HMOs, and millions without coverage, millions who go broke to pay medical bills, millions delaying treatment or delaying retirement because they can't afford to pay? In countries like France, Norway, Finland, socialized medicine, you get better care, lower cost to society. They spend less per capita in these countries, and yet they get better care because there's no profiteering and there's no money being spent marketing and all the other stuff. And you have happier doctors and happier other personnel, and including patients. No one goes without. In this country, it's a joke. I just had an operation 3 weeks ago. And you know, you walk in, you know the first thing you do? I'm writing an article on it now. It's pretty funny. You really don't want to call your doctor. You want to call your lawyer. Yeah. You got all these pages here about transit this and if you that and permission to, and I hereby grant. There was one line in there that terrorized me. It said, I hereby grant the operative crew to remove any member of my body. I said, member? Any member of my body as they so determine needs to be removed. I said, whoa, what am I getting into here? It's lawyers before doctors, you know. Okay. Transportation. That's socialist in Europe, and the trains are better in Europe than in the U.S. Amtrak is better when it's publicly owned. When it gets thrown back and the government has to pick it up again, they put in new rails, they put in new trains and all that, and then they start floating stock, and the stock gets bought, and the private owners start milking that Amtrak all over again. They don't do anything to it, and we have to fork it up again. Capitalism works, if it works at all, because it always has socialism to bail it out and to subsidize it. The trucking industry gets the feds to build the highways. What about just local communities, your fire department? There still are in America any number of fire departments that are private volunteer. They're just not as good, not as well trained, equipped, or available. Public schools are better than charter schools unless their budgets are slashed and all that. That's the way they undermine public sector services, is by defunding them and then saying, oh, you see, that doesn't work. That's not good. Not all things need to be socialized. In Cuba, they are now doing small service businesses, which are, I think, are good. They've had one small service business. It's been privatized. It's for years. Nobody knows about it, but it exists there. And the government did not dare to go in and say, this has to be publicly owned. You know what the business was? It was women's hair. You don't mess with women's hair. Remember this, women's hair is a work in progress. It's always something they're doing, you know. And the communist government backed off and said, okay, we're gonna let that be privatized, okay. And so they got these little beautician shops, you know, women having their hair done. Worker cooperatives. We have right here in Berkeley, the cheese board, get high quality salads and excellent pizza. I don't even like pizza, even though I was raised on it. And workers are sharing, the workers at the cheese board share in the earnings. Now you notice I didn't say share in the profits, I said share in the earnings, because they earned it. Profits are what you get when not working. For not working, that's what profit is. I've had that problem. Somebody come up and say to you, well, don't you make profits on your book? I said, no, I wrote the book, you jack. I wrote the book. I sat. And the editors who go over it and insert all their mistakes, they're working on the book. I mean, you can't help the poor dears. They're very confused. And the distributors and the advertisers and the printers who print the book and all, they're all adding value to this product and making it saleable, you see. So none of them are making profits on it. The profits go to the owner of the publishing house. When I was at St. Martin's, the owner was Harold Macmillan. The Macmillan book family, they own St. Martin's Press, one of the biggest presses in America, one of my first books. And you know who Harold Macmillan was? He was Prime Minister of England. I saw him being interviewed years ago, and the guy asked him, he said, well, how do you manage now that you are no longer in politics? And he said, well, the family has a little publishing house that does quite well. And he sniffed like that, and I'm sitting there going, who are you? You know? So, are we having fun yet? Yeah, we are. Okay, I'm going to wrap it up. There's housing co-ops. There are consumer co-ops. Gaurav Perovitz has just done a new book on co-ops in America. They're apparently are quite a few of these things going on. So what we're facing right now, and facing it right down the block here with the Occupy Oakland and such, is that when the people are faced with a rollback of their material interests, their economic democracy, whatever little shreds of it they have, is being further destroyed and such, they then turn to their political democracy and try to mobilize that as a way to protect their economic democracy. Then the struggle by the plutocracy expands from the economic democracy to political democracy, and they start to try to repress our political rights, which is what they're doing as we talk right now. Repression of most peaceful demonstrations, attacks, mass arrests. We see every Occupy movement has been smashed and bullied by the police. The police themselves are militarized. They come at you with percussion grenades and mace and pepper sprays and billy clubs and tear gas canisters that are shot and can kill people. And they've got all sorts of other things. What I like is that these, you know, some of them won't get off there if it's coffee and donut time to go answer a real call. But they're all up there, and they're all marching together, shoulder to shoulder, and got a guy behind them, and they've all been trained. They all get choreographed for this, and they're getting off on this, being able to beat up these young people sitting there, not so young. And they're suppressing the vote. They dominate the airwaves. They now just passed autocratic legislation, the National Defense Authorization Act, you know, which gives the president power to incarcerate and hold without charges or trial or evidence anybody he so wishes, citizen or not. And when Carl Levin, who supposedly is a liberal senator from Michigan, turned around and said, well, we did, getting a little uncomfortable about, you know, didn't want to lose his credentials. We did say to President Obama, we can take that phrase out. He said, no, leave it in. The guy is full of deception. So what is to be done? First and foremost, ideological struggle. We really have to understand something that the reactionaries and the Republicans and Fox News has known and operates with, which is that ideas count, images count, but they also need to be in an ideological scenario. They have to give them an explanation as to why these things are happening, not just to denounce them, but to understand why it's happening, whose interests, cui bono, who benefits from it, how do we pay for it, what our interests are. We have to also struggle in the workplace, class struggle, create new workplaces, that's why I mentioned the co-ops and such, alternative institutions, but publicize the co-op. When you build a co-op, publicize it. Give the public a reason why this is the... Explain to them why it's different than if this thing was owned by Tip Top Bread or Wonder Bread or somebody like that. First of all, it's better quality because the other guys are not interested in making bread. They're interested in making a profit. So, theory and practice. The Occupy movement has been smashed by police action, but that's only one aspect. That's the camping of it. Right now, the Occupy movement are meeting, and they're having a big conference. They're having panels and teach-ins. And this is part of the way to raise consciousness, to get people to think differently, think outside that horrible, suffocating box that they try to put us in. I remember years ago during the Vietnam period, there was no shortage of people who would sit on their butts and they'd say, how are you going to stop the Vietnam War by demonstrating? Or they'd say, how are you going to stop the Vietnam War by handing in your draft card or burning it or getting arrested or writing to Congress? I did all those things, by the way. What happened, we did turn opinion around. I mean, of course, the durability of the war and the courageous persistence of the Vietnamese people were the major factor. But the point is, it did reach a point where the U.S. military wasn't fighting. Units were refusing to make contact with the enemy. They'd be sent down the road to go fight, and they'd all sit down on the side of the road and toke up, you know, and pass around. or they would frag their officers if the officer got too persistent and all that. And it reached a point where it was getting shaky, where suddenly there was a feeling at the very top that we might not be able to elicit the empowering responses that sustain our rule. And if you don't give them your empowering response, then they become powerless, you see. So democratic struggle can help us make gains, small gains and such. It can be our last line of defense, but at the same time, it can bring victories when things look most hopeless. Thank you very much.
That was the second half of a one-hour talk on the pathology of wealth by the internationally known, award-winning author and lecturer Michael Parenti. He was recorded in January 2012 in Berkeley, California, by filmmaker John Paroulis. Michael Parenti is one of the nation's leading progressive political analysts. Raised in a working-class district of New York City, Parenti went on to earn a PhD in political science from Yale. He lost his chance at an academic career when he was beaten and arrested during one of the many rallies against the war on Vietnam that he attended. In spite, or maybe because, his exclusion from academia and the Ivory Tower, Parenti's highly informative and entertaining books and talks have reached a wide range of audiences in North America and abroad. He's the author of over 20 books, among them Democracy for the Few, History as Mystery, and, most recently, The Face of Imperialism. His website is michaelparenti.org. You can hear this program again on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look under Newest Programs. TUC Radio has moved to Northern California. This program was produced off the grid with solar power. You can get information on how to order an audio CD of Michael Parenti's talk, The Pathology of Wealth, by calling 1-707-463-2654. And I will repeat that number in a moment. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation or CD order keeps this program on the air. Call anytime at 707-463-2654 for information on how to order. You can get your CD by mail or credit card by phone or online on TUC Radio's secure website, tucradio.org. TUC Radio takes its name from an aeronautical term. Time of useful consciousness is the time between the beginning of oxygen deficiency and the loss of consciousness, the brief moment in which a pilot may save the plane. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.